And from the KTUL newsroom, I'm Jamie Deep. First, we have a correction on the free lunch for federal workers story we ran yesterday. Eric Antrim manages bridge inspections across the Tongass and Chugach National Forests. And dozens of attendees at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention stood in protest during U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan's speech this morning. Throughout Sullivan's 35-minute address, people stood with their backs to the stage. Some held signs defending Medicaid. Sullivan supported a bill that cuts $1 trillion from the health care program over a decade. Others held signs supporting public radio, which Sullivan voted to defund. Sullivan touted multiple provisions in the federal budget reconciliation bill that he said would be a boon for Alaska.
What I like to call the Alaska Opportunity Act, because there are so many things in this bill that we have been trying to get done as a state for our Native communities.
The bill also imposes volunteer and work requirements for Medicaid, but he emphasized that Alaska Native people are exempt from those requirements. In a brief interview after his speech, he didn't clarify what steps recipients would have to take to prove they qualify for those exemptions.
There's obviously ways you got to verify it. You can't, you know, you got to apply and verify it. I don't have the details, but we're getting the funding and it's in the law, and that's important.
In his convention speech, Sullivan also said he and his team worked, quote, night and day to make sure our rural radios continue to get the funding they need to stay on the air, end quote. In July, Sullivan was one of 51 senators who voted to claw back all federal funding for public broadcasting stations across the country. He defended that vote after his speech on ideological grounds.
I've been saying for years that NPR, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, was at risk with funding because it was biased reporting. And you and I might disagree, but I think it was very biased left-wing reporting across the country.
More than a dozen rural Alaska public radio stations that lost federal money were recently granted one-time funding from the Department of Interior, which Sullivan took credit for. AFRN runs through Saturday afternoon. This is KTOO. Juneau residents got a glimpse of what life in town looked like in the mid-20th century in Kodachrome video. A family donated 8mm film reels to the Juneau Douglas City Museum, who had them digitized and presented parts of the videos this week at Gold Town Theater. KTOO's Yvonne Krumrie reports.
In the packed and dark theater, Karen Maselli watches home videos flick across the screen while a two-man band plays along. They're her own family's videos, set in Juneau between the 1930s and 50s. Maselli's grandparents, Helly and Lucille Stonehouse, lived in Juneau in the mid-1900s. Harry worked for the railroad and made enough money to buy a piece of advanced technology, a video camera. But until now, Maselli had never seen the footage from her mother's childhood.
Heard stories about fishing and ice skating and when the lake was frozen, or when Mendenhall Glacier Lake was frozen, and my mom would talk about ice skating on it. And so we heard those stories.
2 years ago, Maselli's sister donated the family's 36 color film reels to the Juneau Douglas City Museum. And with a grant from the Alaska State Museum, the curators sent the reels to Anchorage to be digitized. Maselli came to town from Washington State to see the films. They show a part of her family history that had only lived in stories before now.
Well, that's why I think I'm so emotional, is it just, you know, seeing my mom when she was little and, yeah.
Museum staff organized the clips into a presentation according to the seasons, and many of the shots feature landscapes around Juneau. A much larger Mendenhall Glacier draws gasps from the audience. People ice skate on frozen lakes and ski down sharp turns. Cows lie down in a pasture in the Mendenhall Valley. Men and women fish for salmon together along a rocky shoreline. A toddler plays on the beach at Auk Recreation Area. Some footage shows the 1946 Fourth of July parade, with its marching band, intricate floats, and the beloved soapbox derby, where young men built mini cars and raced them through the streets of downtown Juneau. But some shots are just snapshots of everyday life. Museum director Beth Weigel says it's exciting to see even the more mundane parts of life from that time, like feeding ducks and having a picnic at Sandy Beach. As often, that isn't what people would choose to document in expensive color film.
There's only a limited amount of that we can see into the past.
And even though this isn't her family's footage, Weigel says it can make anyone sentimental.
They're just sort of, you know, like, oh, what a time to have that ability to be with your family so much and picnic and hang out and do fun things.
But she says so much of that joy and connectedness is a part of Juneau today.
I think Juneau's like that, though, still in many ways.
And Maselli, with the Stonehouse family, says the full theater gives her a sense of Juneau's togetherness.
I mean, so many people came out. I mean, that's just amazing to us because we thought it would be the four of us and then the museum people, our friends at the museum, and you. And then to have this whole thing practically full when we got here, I mean, that's pretty amazing, the community support and all of that.
Museum staff say they plan to make some of the digitized films available online in the future. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery.
Many smaller communities across Alaska face a shortage of affordable housing. Community leaders in Ketchikan and Saxman have teamed up with the state to help meet that need. KRBD's Sydney Dauphiné has more.
In the native village of Saxman, a few miles south of Ketchikan, construction is wrapped up on brand new affordable housing units. Community leaders celebrated the project with a ribbon cutting last weekend, and people toured some of the new apartments. These four units are next to the Saxman Community Center off Tongass Avenue. There are 14 units total in four different buildings, and they're all within walking distance of each other. Many have tall ceilings and big windows. Some are wheelchair accessible, with shorter countertops and ramps leading up to the doors. All of them feature two bedrooms, one bathroom, and a full kitchen and living room.
They got dishwasher, stove, washer and dryer, yes. And then also as well...
In nearby Ketchikan, the need for affordable housing isn't new. Borough Mayor Rodney Dial says they've been looking for solutions to the shortage for a long time now.
The housing has to be affordable. It needs to be at a level at which people can, you know, afford to make those monthly payments and then still have money for food and the necessities of life. So it's a way to solve many different social problems with just a house.
Some of that work has been in the form of grants, like from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The AHFC had just come up with the Last Frontier Housing Initiative based on where housing needs are the most persistent, including communities like Nome, Kotzebue, Sitka, and Ketchikan. Local community leaders, including Dial, met with the AHFC in 2023 to come up with a plan. The city was given around $4.5 million and a year and a half to complete construction.
It's really critical to our economy. Now, you know, you can call it workforce housing in some regards, because unless we have affordable housing units, we know that young people aren't going to be able to live here. They won't stay. They won't come back after college.
The AHFC used COVID money that would have otherwise expired to fund the projects. The Saxman units are the first to be completed. AHFC Director Stacy Barnes says there was immediate buy-in from Ketchikan and Saxman community leaders.
Part of what the city and the borough agreed to do with Saxman is actually realign their bus route and the timing so that people who are living in these units will have the opportunity to come into Ketchikan for employment or childcare, whatever it is that they might need. And so in terms of community commitment, I think that speaks volumes.
Saxman Mayor Frank Saluto says he hopes for more affordable housing projects in the future.
I would like to keep building, but it's up to the city council on where they would like to go. I'm all about building more houses.
Applications for all 14 units are available now. You can find them at the Saxman City Center. For KRBD, I'm Sydney Dauphiné.
And Western Alaska residents from the storm-ravaged communities of Kipnuk and Quiguilinguk continued to land Thursday night in Anchorage at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, carrying backpacks and plastic bags filled with their belongings as they exited a military transport plane. Hundreds of miles from home, not knowing if or when they would return, they then boarded school buses bound for emergency shelters or, in some cases, to stay with friends or family. The Thursday night flight was the third of its kind this week after efforts to move displaced residents from Bethel to Anchorage began Wednesday. The National Guard expected more to arrive Friday and Saturday. Alaska National Guard Colonel Christy Brewer says the goal is to get everybody who wants to be evacuated to Anchorage. She says some decided to stay in Bethel or to go to other communities.
Those who are willing to stay behind or who want to stay in their communities, we support that as well. And we're doing what we can to help shelter them and transport them to where they need to be.
Brewer says evacuation operations will continue for as long as needed to get people to safety. The National Guard is still dropping food, water, and other supplies to other storm-impacted villages that haven't been evacuated, and they are continuing to deploy maintenance staff to repair damaged power generators. It's unclear where the evacuees in Anchorage will go in the long term. For now, some are staying in shelters at the Alaska Airlines Center on the University of Alaska Anchorage campus and the city's Egan Civic and Convention Center downtown. Both are managed by the American Red Cross, and hundreds of additional disaster workers from across the country are headed to Alaska to help. Erin McCann is a deputy coordinator with the Red Cross. She says that manpower extends beyond just the Anchorage shelters.
Some will go to Bethel, and then we're hoping to do distribution of emergency supplies out in the affected villages. And during that process, folks will actually get out to all the affected villages when they're out.
Dave Riley, Deputy Operations Section Chief with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, says that Anchorage shelters are equipped to hold up to 2,000 individuals total. First, Riley says the emergency response in Anchorage is to provide immediate shelter and medical aid, but it's also aimed at the longer road ahead for the evacuees.
Winter is coming pretty fast. How do we shelter them and be respectful of them and their communities and their culture for the long term till we get to where we can rebuild their homes?
Local, state, and federal officials are still working on a longer-term plan. In the meantime, Riley says the state is prepared to provide individual assistance to help secure hotel rooms, apartments, and houses, quote, so we can give them some kind of a life back again. And in Juneau right now, it is 48 degrees and raining, and rain will stay in the forecast through this weekend. Tonight, it'll continue to rain with a low around 43 degrees with an east wind around 10 miles per hour. And temperatures will continue to swing between the low and upper 40s through the rest of this weekend into early next week. You're listening to KTOO. Thank you so much for tuning in. For more, head to ktoo.org.